Welcome to the podcast. It's actually been a couple of weeks, and I apologize for that because I had meant to record an episode actually on a topic suggested by Clortos Dragon, and actually also he would have been the guest. But then I caught something from one of my coworkers, I think. I'm not sure, but I was the only one in the family who got sick, and then my wife got it from me, but none of the kids seem to have got it, so I'm thinking it's not one of the ones that came in from the schoolyard at any rate. But, there I go. Tea. I will not inhale my tea. That is my goal. So anyways, you've got two of us on the podcast tonight. We are not joined again by Linguistic. He is still off and gone on his travels, but returning tonight, we have Gradia Dragon. Hello, Gradia.
Hey there. Good night, everyone.
Yes, definitely. And we hope they are having a good night. Or a good day. I mean, we're recording this at night, but who knows when people are going to actually be listening. Starting off, have a couple of shout-outs that I want to give out here. First off, big thanks to Neil, who recently adjusted, and upward, just so we're clear, adjusted his Patreon pledge, supporting the Ultima Codex. So bringing us, we're starting to kind of close in on that point where I can think about, you know, okay, I can have enough to actually, like, upgrade the server. That would be good. And I'd also like to give, and this is kind of admittedly self-serving, but you know what? I'm going to go with it. I just launched a second podcast because I'm a crazy person, and it's called Scouting Stuff You Should Know. So that's what I want to give the shout out to, is Scouting Stuff You Should Know. We're actually only on the first episode right now.
Scouting.
Yes. Scouts. Yeah, we're only on the first episode. We'll be recording the second next week, give or take. Wednesday. Mostly, it's been a chance for me to sit down and chat about, scouting, with, you know, I've been kind of a big proponent of the scouting movement, for quite a while. I mean, I was 20 years a youth member, and I've been a leader now for about 5. So, so the first episode actually, it involves me and my good friend Colin, who I basically went through scouting with from about age 5. We were also joined by Brian Martin, which makes it actually something of a trans-border podcast, because Colin and I are involved with Scouts Canada, Brian is involved with the Boy Scouts of America. And yes, it is that Brian Martin, also, you know, in a previous life, a designer on Ultima 7 and some other games of that nature. And then finally, and somewhat cheesily, here is a big shout out to everybody who listens to the podcast, because we actually just crossed 100,000 listens on Podbean, which means that we probably crossed 100,000 listens a while ago. But of course, when I was just running this off of the Codex, I didn't have as much in the way of stats tracking. So, but now I can verifiably say we've crossed 100,000 listens, and that's no trivial thing. And it's really great that you all continue to offer us your support and your ears. The others, well, I shouldn't say that. Linguistic isn't here this week. Kevin isn't here this week, but Gradia is. But I'm pretty sure I can say thank you on behalf of those who are absent. So thank you. All right. Speaking of Podbean, actually, we have a few new listeners, or a few new followers, rather, on Podbean. We've got the Critical Mass podcast, another gaming podcast, might be worth checking out. Megadito, Toby Shaw, and Lyric Listeners. And there are also, I was actually really happy to see, there are also a bunch of new Ultima Dragons at UDSC.org. I believe the last one that we... Yeah, okay, so he was the last one. So since the last time we did a call-out, we've added... Who have we added? Imperial Dragon. Absalard. Oh, whoops. Imperial Dragon, Summer Dragon, Bitoku Kishi Dragon, Eonoid Dragon, Agnostic Dragon, and Deadbeat Dragon. Well then. And then on the Facebook side, we actually have a bunch of new members as well on the Facebook group. Nobody joined Google Plus this week or over the last week. But, oh my gosh, I hope that's not going to be a thing. But anyways, Facebook, we've got Jonathan, Kate, Charles, Matt, Lucy, Heiko, Donner, Sherry Grainer Ray actually joined the group formally. So another one of the Origin developers, or ex-Origin developers, coming on board. There's a few of them now. Haldor and Zoltan, or maybe Paul. And also a welcome back to David, who rejoined the group. Oh my goodness, excuse me. You can see I'm not completely over the cold, but can't go more than a couple weeks without an episode, I think. So we're going to power through this one tonight. Weirdly, for me, I find that I actually agree with at least one paragraph in a Kotaku article, one entire paragraph. This was The Gamer Parents Dilemma. It was published a while ago by Chris Sullentrop. The paragraph in question reads thusly: we are the first generation of parents who grew up playing video games, which makes us the first moms and dads to possess the wisdom to guide our children through the world of PlayStation, Steam, Nintendo, and the like. Rather than the desire to merely abandon them to it, we are tasked with figuring this out for ourselves. It's our job, our responsibility, to establish some traditions. And now, for his part, Sullentrop bemoans what he describes as his misspent youth, during which time he uncritically gobbled up whatever tripe was served to him. At least as far as video games go. I can't personally relate to that. I've spoken before on the podcast, I think, and certainly on the Codex, about my own formation as a gamer, which that was a process that was mostly shepherded actually by my grandfather, and at best tolerated by my parents. And the first few games I was ever introduced to were roughly in this order: Winnie the Pooh and the Hundred Acre Wood, Mixed Up Mother Goose, Ultima 6, Heroes Quest, later Quest for Glory 1, Commander Keen, and then stuff like Word Rescue, Island of Dr. Brain, King's Quest 6, and Eagle Eye Mysteries. You'll note that these are basically all PC games. One of my uncles... one of my uncles did own an Atari console, and one of my friends had a Nintendo Entertainment System. And I did play occasionally on those, but for the most part I grew up playing games on PC, and then actually really good games. Now, until recently, I probably would have counted myself in total agreement with a couple of other paragraphs in Sullentrop's article, where he notes, you know, when it comes to reading with your kids, there's a well-trod path to follow, from board books to Sandra Boynton and Dr. Seuss to Judy Blume and C.S. Lewis. Music and television similarly overflow with possibilities. Non-digital forms of play have obvious go-to options too, a skill tree that has served us well for decades. Where's the video game version of Candyland, which is, you know, essentially a game designed to teach kids how to play a board game? Or The Cat in the Hat, or Sesame Street, or Old MacDonald Had a Farm. He goes on to say, the one thing I won't do, take the bananas approach prescribed by Andy Bio in Medium for his son. He methodically required his offspring to play through each generation of video games as he experienced them in chronological order. From the arcade age, to Atari, to Nintendo, Famicom, to Super, to 64 and beyond. To Sega and Sony and Microsoft. Now, there's a certain logic to wanting to start at the beginning, but it's more difficult for a kindergartner to manipulate a gamepad than it was for me to use its training wheels equivalent, an Atari joystick. I don't know. Like I say, up until recently, I would have actually completely agreed with that thought, is that you know, just because, okay, just because of personality types, we've had to enforce some pretty strict limits on screen time with our kids. And most of the games they've been introduced to, apostrophe abuse, I've been introduced to, they've been on the modern side. I mean, my eldest is, you know, in a sense, she's now ready for Winnie the Pooh and the 100-Acre Wood, which actually has a pretty steep reading requirement, for one. And I've tried introducing her to it a couple of times, but it doesn't really click with her. And I can't really blame her for that. I mean, when you're used to playing modern, colorful games with crisp audio and lots of interactivity, it's difficult to grok a game that's, you know, very static in its presentation, throws paragraphs of text at you, and has about four colors in total, most of which is, a you know, black. I mean, it's just line art on a black screen, basically. That isn't to say that we haven't tried to, my wife and I haven't tried to curate the games the girls are exposed to. They still play the heck out of Castle of Illusion, starring Mickey Mouse, the 2013 remake, on my wife's laptop. And in fact, she played it through with them the first time it came out. And they really dig, like, iOS games that companies like Toca Boca put out, which, honestly, I have to admit, I greatly enjoy as well. Even my little one, who's just over 2 years old, will happily throw together a jam session in Toca Band and then dance around the living room to the music that comes out of the phone. I did, however, introduce them to the VGA remake of Mixed Up Mother Goose, which they also enjoy greatly. But outside of that, I haven't really done much with introducing them to older games, you know, games that I would have grown up with. Of course, I'm rethinking that now, in light of a couple of recent events. Pardon me. The first took place when we took the kids out to, you know, the very Canadian named place, Moose Lake, where my wife's uncle actually volunteers his summers at a Ukrainian Orthodox Church youth camp. He sets up a big trailer there for the season and mostly deals with cooking related tasks around the camp, which, you know, means lots of tasty treats from a wood fired oven for his guests. For the last couple of summers, though, we've headed out there and spent a weekend, you know, just enjoying some time at the lake and at the camp, because, you know, like, my kids really like the obstacle course, for example. This year, the weather was not the best when we went out, so we actually spent at least part of one afternoon in the trailer playing games. Card games, board games, and then my wife's uncle hauled out this Jack's Pacific, I guess is the company that makes it, you know, Pac-Man Retro Arcade TV box. I don't exactly know what the model is called specifically, but it's a decent enough description. It's this little box that, you know, has a joystick and two buttons, and you hook it up to a television, and you can play about a dozen different Namco Bandai classic video games, which my kids, oh my goodness, they just ate right up. Pac-Man especially, and oddly enough, Bosconian. Sort of a multi-directional space shooter. And then, a couple of weeks back, I was working on one of the computers here at home, and my eldest asked me about one of the icons, Commander Keen. So I showed her the game. I mean, it boots up into, it's the Steam package, so it boots up into Keen 1 by default. And since then, she's asked to play it at least every few days, and I really actually should indulge that curiosity at some point. Because she's not unfamiliar with platformers, although I dare say that learning how to grasp Commander Keen and its handling, which, let's be reasonable, is wonky as all get out, it's very different from learning how to handle, you know, a much smoother and more refined game like Mega Run, another popular one on the phones these days. So when I put together, you know, a small PC for the living room, we had previously put space there for my wife to dock her laptop, but she doesn't really do that anymore. I loaded it up with a few old games, not Commander Keen. I think if I'm going to introduce them to, like, old school platformers, I'm going to start them with Word Rescue, which is It's actually, I believe, it's an Apogee game as well. And it's kind of somewhat similar in design and handling, with, you know, a little bit of light reading teaching. Word picture matching. At the same time, I don't think I'm going to go full Andy Bio, although I am contemplating getting one of those Jax boxes, because, man, did they love playing Pac-Man. That said, what else is on that computer right now? I loaded it up with the King's Quests, although I'm not going to introduce them to those yet. Mixed Up Mother Goose is back on there. Word Rescue, Math Blaster. Games that I remember playing, you know, way back when. Oh, and the Eagle Eye Mysteries. Yeah, Eagle Eye Mysteries is on there too. So. But anyways, so, you know, well, I'm not going to go like full Andy Bio, make them progress through each thing successfully, you know, each age of gaming, as it were. I am going to continue, I think, to curate games for PC and mobile alike that are, you know, age appropriate. And I'll try, I think, more now to present them a mix of old and new. I don't think I'll quite step them into Ultima just yet. Because, you know, my eldest is only 6. I mean, maybe by age 8, that might be just right. And, of course, I'll start it with Ultima 6, because why wouldn't I? But, but anyways, yeah, that's the, funnily enough, that's actually the end of what I had written. But it's, you know, it's been something that I've been thinking about a fair bit lately, just because, you know, like, I mean, there's more that I want my kids to do with a computer than just be able to play games, definitely. But at the same time, you know, I do agree with, like, you know, Father Roderick and others who comment that, you know, games are, and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before too, that games are big. They're really big. The games industry, especially if you lump in mobile, is bigger than the movie industry and the music industry and probably even the television industry all put together. Which means that, you know, if you're going to engage with, if you're going to bring up people to engage with the culture, if you're going to, you know, for yourself, engage with where the culture is at, games are a big part of that. Understanding, you know, understanding games and understanding why people play them and understanding what they're looking for when they go to play them. That's a huge part of culture. And I think we're coming to the point too, where, you know, more and more people are starting to really look at games, not just as sort of forms of escapist entertainment, but as, you know, much like with movies, much like with TV, much like with other forms of media, you know, vehicles for messages, for cultural commentary, for things like that. So, you know, definitely, I think, you know, I mean, I grew up a gamer, and I definitely want to pass that on to my kids, because I think it's really great. But it almost feels like it's even more pressing than that, too, because, you know, when I was playing, you know, Ultima 6 on my grandpa's computer at his place, it was a great game. It was a best-selling RPG, I'm sure, but the appeal of games hadn't exploded in the same way that it has now. And, you know, so what my parents could write off as, yeah, just this niche thing that he happens to be interested in, I definitely can't take that same approach. And I wouldn't want to. But, you know, there's no way to even justify really taking that view anymore. Games are huge. Yeah, and I see that, you know, bringing this back to scouting for a minute, too, I see this with, you know, like the Beavers as well. Beaver Scouts in Canada is for 5 to 7 year olds. So, I mean, two of my kids are in that particular part of the movement, and I am one of the leaders. And so, you know, just even being able to interact with the other kids in the group, it really pays, it really helps to have a working knowledge of, you know, well, what are kids 5, 6, 7 years old playing? Which still is mostly Minecraft. Because Minecraft is, you know, ubiquitous now. And so, it's, you know, it's important to understand it as a game, and just to understand, you know, again, the appeal of games to young children, just to be able to relate to them now. It's really quite an interesting additional bit of challenge. So I'm just talking and coughing here. Gradia, you've been so silent the whole time.
Yeah, I've been just thinking. Well, I still don't have kids, but I was thinking about my parents. And one of the things I've been reflecting right now is that they're pretty much different from other parents. When I was a kid, I remember my mom was able to identify all of DC Comics superheroes.
Whoa.
She was if I was watching cartoons from DC superheroes, she would know The Flash, Superman, Batman, Robin, Wonder Woman, everyone and their the villains. She would know which were their superpowers. And she grew up reading comics. And my father, too. And, well, when I was introduced to video games, my father tried to guide me into playing certain kind of games. I remember, my friends remember, when I was a teenager, I had this sophisticated... Well, I was the only one with a computer in elementary school. No one else had a computer back then. And I had this controller, this flight simulators. It was the joystick, which had the trigger buttons, the hat switch, the missile buttons, and the base had several other different buttons and switches for programming. It had a cable which connected to the keyboard. It had an additional connector on which I plugged the other half of the controller, which was the throttle.
Oh, jeez.
And this throttling controller had a port for connecting to the serial port, and on the thumb of the control, there was a trackball.
Oh, jeez.
And so everything, I was able to program it to work as a keyboard and mouse at the same time. And he wanted me to play flight simulators and driving games. Also, he also liked fighting games, because one of the things he considered that I should know was how to shoot a gun and how to fight. Shooting guns, fighting with my hands, legs, my whole body, driving a car, and flying an airplane. So that's basically what most of the games that I played back when I was 6, 7, 8 years old.
Yeah, I grew up across the alley from that.
And then there were other games which I started playing, but he didn't like many of them. Like the action-adventure games, for example, Legend of Zelda, Castlevania. Mm-hmm. He didn't like that kind of games because he said the skills I was getting from them weren't really useful. He liked games like, for example, from Nintendo, he liked Duck Hunt. Because I was actually shooting and interacting, he would take me to a shooting range and I would shoot. But safely at home, it was duck hunting.
Duck hunt was always fun.
And ESPN. That's usually the kind of games I was introduced to by All him. Right. Also, he liked that I played our role-playing games because back at the time, those games involved lots of reading.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the Ultima series, the manuals, they have lots of text, and I was reading text. And he liked the fact that I was reading. And not only that, because, well, we're Mexican, so my native language is Spanish. So I was practicing English, which is a skill, a very important skill to know how to read and speak English.
Yeah. I think I've told this story before a few times, certainly on the Codex, possibly on the podcast. This is more of an anecdote because I don't like naming names, but and I don't know, maybe this happened to you too. But I do know a few people who've, you know, the Ultima games especially were one of their first and principal exposures to, yeah, the English language, right? Because they grew up in non-English speaking or non-English speaking countries. European, Central, South American, wherever. But for some of them, it was so much the case that Ultima was like the primary driver of their learning English that even actually still to this day, they will occasionally fall into that kind of faux Middle English. Like in terms of like their word choice or like, yeah. So I don't know if that was your experience, but I've heard from a few people where, you know, they almost had to then unlearn some of the English that they learned, especially from the Ultimas, because it was that faux Middle English and all the these and thous and other idioms that, you know, are archaic. We don't use them in modern English anymore. So.
Yeah, I already have some knowledge of English, and I always found it odd to read it that way on the Ultimate Games. And my father once told me that that's because it's some old form of English. It's not, since those are knights and dragons and wizards, they read it so that the English they use is it's an old form of English. It's not modern English.
Yeah.
And that was one of the appealing things from the game to me.
Well, that's right, because it was kind of that little anachronism, that little taste of, you know, history. And actually useful in a certain sense, because, you know, like when you encounter Shakespeare all of a sudden, you're just like, oh, well, this is familiar.
Yeah, and then I tried doing the same with Japanese, but I learned a little, but it's not the same because there, at least there's not so much Japanese around me to be practicing it all day like I do with English.
Yeah.
But I learned several words, phrases, and the writing.
Yeah, I gather that's also a tricky language to pick up. Although a few other people I know through the Dragons have are really quite good with it, including Dungy or Dungy from the Wiki team. He's really fluent in English or in Japanese. Of course, he's fluent in English. Actually, I think his wife is Japanese too.
One of the things I have seen comparing the games I played back then with the games right now is, as you mentioned, new games are more colorful or more graphically intensive. And sometimes it's harder to see what's the concept behind them.
Sometimes,
or the main mechanic. And sometimes by the looks it's more appealing, but something I've learned through life, and I have what I had a talk like this with a woman once. She was very concerned that she was not as attractive as she wanted to, and she was really frustrated. And I started thinking and related this with video games. I told her, think of video games. Look at all those new games with impressive graphics. Everyone looks at them and they go straight there. And after playing with those games for a while, there are some which stand out and some which they just play a few hours and then leave it and never touch them again.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other games with very simple graphics. Sometimes the graphics are not so impressive. Sometimes they look outdated or antiquated. But you get to know those, and you have a much better time with them than you do with those flashy, more colorful or visually perfect games. Because there's an essence. They have an essence. And the other is nothing more than a hook to pull you in and get you to know them. But once they pull you and you get to know them, that visual appeal disappears. It becomes irrelevant. Because you're now touching the essence. And you say, this is not what I want. This is not what I like. This doesn't make me feel good. And then there's a moment when you stop looking at all those graphics and flashy things and you start looking more at the essence. There's a moment when you grow up and stop looking at the visuals and start getting deeper into the essence of the game. And you start to actually love games and get to really know and master them. And that's when you really enjoy games.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of it's like the distinction between, you know, infatuation versus love, right? It's like, you know, there's kind of that short-term intense onset that's like, you know, the infatuation period. But then if there's, you know, if all you have is that, yeah, it's not going anywhere. That relationship is not even going to become a relationship in a any sort of meaningful sense. Versus, you know, I mean, if you are able to, you know, develop more complex and mature emotions after that point, well, great, good. Then that's where it'll endure. I mean, I think an argument can be made that, you know, within each generation of games, the past generations of games and the current generation as well, like there are, you were right when you said, you know, there's going to be those titles that do just like, they stand out, not just because of graphics. I mean, it's always neat to see games that can deliver immense visual fidelity because it's, to me at least, it's cool, like, you know, what we're even able to do with technology these days. But obviously, yeah, that graphical fidelity, that, you know, how pretty it looks on screen only gets you so far, you know, if there isn't that engagement from story, if there isn't that engagement from the gameplay and the mechanics and everything else that's going into the game, well, it looks pretty and that's about the extent of it. And it's like, okay, well, I've seen the screenshots. I'm good. I don't need to go any further with this. Versus, you know, there are standout games from really each generation of games. Just as there are crappy games from each generation of games. And I think the real, I think the takeaway from that is that, you know, as long as you can continue to run them, those standout games from each generation how they look becomes irrelevant, you know? Like, I mean, I can remember playing Ultima 6 the first time, and it was like, oh my gosh, wow, this is like the most amazing looking game I've ever seen, because it was 1990 and I had just come off of Winnie the Pooh and the 100 Acre Wood, which has all the color palette of, say, Ultima 2. So, you know, to go from that to Ultima 6, I mean, it's like, wow, this is like, this is a really, really, like, this is such a colorful game, and it looks so awesome, and oh my gosh, look, there's me. I'm this little person, and I'm walking around, and it's the best thing ever. Nowadays, of course, you know, I can look at Ultima 6, and I'm just like, ah, yeah, pixel art, that's great. But, you know, the draw of Ultima 6 is not what it looks like. It's it's what it is, right? It's the story and the brilliant narratives inversion that happens in it.
It's more like...
it's the world. It's
they say there's something special when the game actually makes you feel better when you play it than when you don't.
Yep.
It's kind of hard to grasp at first, because you say, well, if I play games, it's because they make me feel good. That's not always the case. Sometimes we play games that are frustrating, and we get frustrated and angry, but we're still there playing and playing and trying over and over in a very masochistic way.
And the rage quit exists.
And sometimes we are playing and we get mad at the mechanics and we hate the mechanics, but we're still there. And there are games where it makes you feel different. Even the mechanics are irrelevant. You don't really care much about the mechanics, but what you care about is what you feel during the game. It's what in my current job, our manager talks always about what he calls player experience. And he says, there's a player experience we're trying to build. Whenever a server crashes, this breaks the player's experience. Because he's playing, he's inside this world, he's immersed in it. And then you just break it, you just take it away, and that doesn't feel good.
No, it's not fun.
There's a sense of immersion which we need to keep. And when a game managed to attain that level of immersion where you feel like you're inside, that makes you feel good. That's pleasant. And not all of the games are able to attain that.
No, not at all. I mean, that's certainly, you know, that was one of the big appeals of the Ultimas, was the fact that, you know, and I mean, but that was always the intent of it too, right? It's like, you know, you are supposed to be the one who is entering into this world. And the games, for the most part, did exactly that. And they drew you in and, you know, you made Britannia your own. You really did. More recently, like, I felt that way with Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning, which, again, I'm not going to shut up about, so there, take that. You know, again, just that, and I mean, again, like, you know, games like that, like Ultima 6, as long as I can get DOSBox running on whatever computer I happen to be sitting in front of, I will continue playing Ultima 6. As long as I can get Reckoning running on whatever computer I happen to be sitting in front of, or as long as I can keep an old enough computer system limping along that allows me to play it, I'll periodically revisit that game because, you know, yeah, it's just that experience of, you know, engagement and immersion and just that overpowering joy of being in the game world and experiencing it and what it has to offer. And I think, really, if there's value to, you know, marching your kids through the history of video games, it's to give them that, you know, the argument, you know, the, comparing it back to literature or even music is kind of instructive there, right? Because I mean, like, you know, on the one hand, it's not a problem if people like listening to whatever particular kind of, you know, modern music they like listening to. It's not a problem if people like reading whatever passes for, you know, whatever's the going trend in young adult fiction these days, right? But, you know, if all you're reading is, you know, the latest werevampire young adult fiction, it's not so easy to really appreciate the broader context of literature in general, right? Without having other works, past works, works that are, you know, and even occasionally exposure to, you know, works that are acknowledged as genuine classics to kind of serve as a comparison point. It's one thing to like, you know, a particular style of music, but it's can be a bit of an enrichment for that to understand where that musical style comes from, what its influences have been, and how we've gotten to this point. That's not to say that everybody has to like the Beatles. Frankly, I don't like the Beatles. Sorry, Joe. But, you know, it's instructive to know, okay, well, we had the Beatles and this was a phenomenon and it had this impact on music, and that's how we get to this artist today and what they're doing.
Check the latest in music technology. There was a project in a university in Spain. This university is leader in technology in Spain, and it has come up with really, really great stuff. One of them was a software in which you type text and assign musical notation. And you use a special library of sounds.
Okay.
So what you get is singing.
Oh,
and
really?
And then Yamaha funded the project, and Sega also funded the project and created a group of characters. These characters are very popular now. They're called the Vocaloids.
Oh, I've heard of the Vocaloids.
What they
okay.
do, they make musical concerts with a real band, real music band, and there's a holographic projection of the character singing.
Jeez.
And all the singing, the voice is completely digital, and the animation is done by Sega animators. And there are even arcade machines which are jukeboxes from you insert wow. a coin, select the song, and the Vocaloid you wanted to sing the song.
Oh yeah, because it would probably all be interchangeable.
Video with the Vocaloid dancing and singing.
Nice. Well, you know, I mean, it is amazing what they can do with synths with synthesized music these days. And again, you know, but again, it's you can have a deeper appreciation of that having come through the history of synthesized music. You know, think about like the Tron soundtrack, okay, which is like one of the earliest cases of electronic synth music being used as a mainline movie soundtrack. And even then, like, that's Tron came out the same year I did. So but you know, you can go back and you can listen to it now and it's like, this is obviously synthesized, you know, like it's very obviously electronic sounding music. But it was the best tech of the day. Or like the Terminator soundtrack, the original Terminator uses a lot of synth. Where, you know, now we're today at the point where, yeah, you can, you know, just we're at the Vocaloids, or we're at the point where, you know, I remember a case where, you know, like Holt Ehrenfell, who does a lot, and that's his online name, he does a lot of the work with the music for Shroud of the Avatar. I remember he actually lives not too far away. And I remember he flagged me down on Google Plus this is maybe about a year ago. And he's just like, do you have wheels? Yeah, why? I need to get to FedEx. Because he had, you know, shelled out for this really expensive library of instrument voices, basically. And like, I think Portalarium had chipped in for it. I think actually a few people had chipped in for it. And so, you know, we drove to FedEx and we picked it up. And then a couple of days later, he hit me with some samples. And I mean, you know, it's like, yes, this is synthesized music, but I'd be hard pressed to tell you that.
Sounds
I could tell
like an orchestra.
Yeah, it's like, I couldn't tell you the difference.
And the Vocaloid, when an amateur makes music with vocal with Vocaloid software, you know it's synthesized. But when you hear the professionally rendered songs made by Sega, and you hear them, and it looks like a real person.
Yeah, and that's
you
the thing.
You can't really tell.
Yeah, and that's, you know, so it's, and I mean, a lot of that's just because, you know, what they release for free, or what they release, you know, I assume for free, is like, it's much the same with Apple's GarageBand, right? You know, when you get that for the small price you pay for it, the instrument voices aren't, you know, amazing. If you want to get voices, that's a lot
of
additional
money.
The voice
pack for a single Vocaloid is over $100.
Yeah, I believe
it. The software is another $100.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean,
yeah,
even then,
it's not that simple to write a song and then make it look real and make it sound real. But it takes a lot of work, but it can be done. Mm-hmm.
But we have gotten to the point where professionally done synthesized music is indistinguishable from live recorded music, except to like someone who has the most trained ear possible, versus, you know, and, you know, so people coming into the world just now maybe aren't ever going to realize that for 30 years, synthesized music was always kind of, you can make nice music with this, but you can tell that's a drum machine. You can tell that's a fake, you know, that's a computer generated string sound. And now all of a sudden we're at this point where it's just like, wow, I had no idea that there was no actual orchestra there. And, so you can kind of appreciate that maybe a little bit more, having either gone through or having become aware at least of, you know, where synthetic music has come from. And I think it's much the same with games. You know, like it's not a bad thing at all to, you know, appreciate a great game within the generation of games you happen to be in. Nothing wrong with that at all. Like, by all means, great games should be lauded. They really should. But it can enhance your perspective to then also be able to look back and say, well, you know, so here's how we have, you know, this game from 20 years ago, and here's, you know, where we can see how that game has had this impact on these games today. Right. I mean, we talk about that a lot with Ultima anyways, right? You know, like Ultima 4 introducing morality as a gameplay element, and hello, BioWare, things like that. So I do think there's a lot of value to, you know, being able to experience these games for yourself, to, you know, to get that perspective. I mean, I don't actually expect that Ella is going to enjoy playing. And my eldest is going to enjoy playing Commander Keen all that much. Because, you know what? I mean, platformers haven't changed too much. They really haven't. You know, the graphics have gotten, you know, smoother and more refined. But, you know, the general concept of a platformer really isn't any different. You go from one side of the screen to the other, you pick up certain things, you avoid certain things, and then you either jump on or shoot at certain things, and you finish the level and you're done. But, you know, like, I mean, I play stuff like, you know, Mega Run. I mean, I play all the games that I let them play. So, you know, like I played Mega Run and I play some of the other ones that they're experiencing now. And the controls are just like, they're very refined, right? Because these developers are coming in now. They're benefiting from, you know, 30, 40 years of platform game development that has gone before, right? You know, a lot of the mistakes have already been made and solutions have already been figured out. So people coming in now ideally aren't having to reinvent the wheel. But then you go back, you know, I go back and I play Commander Keen afterwards and I'm just like, oh man, like the just how he lags a little bit when he responds and how the jumping is a little bit mushier and just, you know, that was back when they still hadn't figured out the complete moat, you know, how to smooth out that motion. Right.
So I love the ledge grabbing.
In four onward. Yes. That was always fun. And what I always liked was, and I mean, it wasn't always easy to pull this off, but what I always liked was like, if I knew that there were some enemies in a pit, then like jumping across the pit and then you could shoot down. And then you could just kind of carpet bomb the pit and, oh yeah, shoot up too. But you could just like carpet bomb the pit and then jump down and get whatever was down there. Except those jumping rocks, because of course you couldn't shoot those things from the top. You had to get them in mid jump. So.
Anyways. Those were the most annoying. Those and the flying pests.
Yes. Yes. Because you didn't, the little flies, but they didn't kill you. They would just appear at like the most inadvertent time and you'd like be in mid jump and then you'd bounce off of one of these things and into the spike pit you go.
Now you're talking about the red bouncing balls.
Oh, no, there were little bugs too.
I'm talking about some kind of insects which came out flying. If they touch you, they kill you.
Did the insects kill you?
The only way that you would be able to kill them was wait until they get on the ground and stay static and squish them with the pogo stick.
That's right. Actually, I think you could pogo stick them in midair too.
I never really tried that.
I think I wound up doing that a couple of times. I'd have to go back and think, but I think I did that once or twice. And then, of course, the dope fish. Ah, the dope fish. See, right there, it's like one of those. Life. Yeah, it's one of those iconic creatures, albeit in that case for reasons I have no idea why. But, you know. Actually, the Commander Keen enemy I still, to this day, fear the most are the, it's from Keen 3, it's the Vorta Ninjas. The ninja Vorticons. I'm
trying to remember them because it's been 20 years, I think.
Yeah. They were the worst because they took like they took three ray gun hits. It took three ray gun hits to knock one of them down.
Yeah, the regular Vorticons were two shots, right?
Well, the regular ones I think were one shot. There were a couple that were two, and then the Vorta Ninjas were at least three.
Were two.
Were the regulars two? Oh yeah, you're right. The regulars were two. It was like the little critters that were one shot, like on Mars in the first one.
I remember I was used to the enemies dying with a single shot, and when shot that one and didn't die.
That's right. Yeah, it's like, oh no. But yeah, the Vorta Ninjas, so not only did they take three shots, but they could jump like insanely high. And then all of a sudden, without warning, just this burst of speed, and they'd be like right on you. They were just savage to try and get past. And there's one level in Keen 3 where it's basically like a military base, and that's all you're fighting. It's like 10 Vorta ninjas or 12 Vorta ninjas in the entire level, and you're just like, I'm done. I'm dead. I can't do this. I think my strategy there was basically just load up on charges and just guns blazing the whole way. I only passed it once, though. But, all right. Yeah. Are we good?
Yeah.
All right. I think I'm going to have to call it a night because I'm out of tea and my throat is starting to protest again.
Sure.
So, yeah, well, nasty cold. Oh, well. I apologize to everyone for the amount that I've been coughing. It's just, Anyways, always remember, if you would like to recommend anyone for a shout out, you can send an email to the Ultima Codex. There's a contact form. Or you can just shoot it directly to ultimacodex@gmail.com. That's really cool too. Which you can also use to suggest podcast topics. We've been getting a little bit more of that, so I like that. Offer commentary or criticism, and or volunteer your time as, you know, a contributor if you actually want to step on board and sound off for a bit. And if you do like Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug in particular, think about leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or Podbean or wherever you happen to listen to us. With most of these services, reviews basically make for visibility, right? So you leave a review. I mean, hopefully it's a positive review. Hopefully you actually like us. But, you know, you leave a review, we get a little more visibility out of that. We, you know, it kind of gives us a little bit better positioning in search rankings, I guess, is how it works. And, you know, so that brings us to the attention of more people, apparently. If you haven't already, you should totally sign on with, well, you got the Ultimate Dragons group on Facebook, or there's the community on Google Plus, or just spam the UDIC hashtag on Twitter. As well, there's a Facebook page for the Ultima series. You can give that a like. You can follow the Ultima Codex on Twitter at Ultima Codex. There's also a Google Plus page. If Google Plus is your thing, you can encircle that. And whatever social network you favor, please consider sharing any content that you think might be interesting to other people that gets posted to those profiles. And then finally, there is the Patreon. So the $1 pledge gets you access to Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug the day before it goes live on the Codex proper. And, you know, with that, you'll be helping maintain and, you know, if we can build up sufficient funding, expand the server infrastructure of the Codex to better deliver everything you come looking for thereat, whether it's Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug, whether it's Shroud of the Avatar's IRC channel, whether it's the wiki, the Codex of Ultima Wisdom, all of that. You know, it all lives there, and you help it all out. All right. Well, you want to say goodnight, Gurdia?
Well, there we go. Have a good night. Enjoy the games.
Definitely. Definitely. Oh, hey, I meant to ask. Did you must have backed that Castlevania thing. The spiritual successor that was on Kickstarter. What was it called?
Bloodstained. Ritual of Blood. Ritual of the Night.
Yes. Yes. I'm assuming you went in on that one.
I still haven't been... I haven't checked out since I've been swamped with work and training and stuff.
Well, that's okay. You can pick it up when it comes out. Yeah. I mean, it might take you 2 years to pass for how busy you are, but no, still.
Yes, I think the release is set for 2017.
You got some time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. Apologies again for coughing. And be virtuous.
gonna stray from the path.